Oh, here we go. It's all good. Yes. There we are. Psalm 123. When I was reading the psalm, I was thinking of when we lose something, how do we act? When we lose something, like, what do we do? And the thing that I probably forget about more often than not is my keys, and especially as I'm late, especially as I'm about to leave the house, like right when you need to just be going, then that's the thing of like, oh no, the keys. Thankfully, our door, like a lot of doors, it locks automatically. So if you forget the keys, you can forget about it. It's kind of like, hopefully our neighbors are home, they have our keys, but if not, that's a big deal. I have to wait for Christina or somebody has to wait for someone. When we've lost something, we look for it, like those keys. And is there anything so annoying, so frustrating as to right as you're about to leave, you're like, ah, the keys, and then you can't find them. I normally put them in this thing over here. They're not in that thing. Where are they? And you go all over the house. And if someone was to like trace where you went around the house, it would definitely not be a logical straight line progression. It'd be like all over the place, like here, no, here, there, no. Cushions are in the air, like all these things are going on. And we don't know where they are. Am I okay? Oh yeah, good, cool. Every time we look for something, so as I'm looking for those keys, every time I'm looking for something, we go on a journey. And like most journeys, it's generally not a clear shot. It's going to be all over the place. We drove to Nottinghamshire recently, and if you've ever driven to that area of the country, there's not a clear shot. You have to go over to like Sheffield and then go south. It feels like a complete waste of time. Like if only there was a road that went right there, it'd be so nice. But there's not. You go over, then you go. So that's what a journey. When we're looking for something, that's what a journey can look like. It can look like going all sorts of like squiggles and circles and tracking back on itself all over the time. And similar to those lost keys, this psalm, this song, starts with a sense that something is lost. There's needing something that we don't have. And it takes us on a journey to find that thing. A reminder just about this series, the Psalms of Ascents. There are 15 psalms, Psalms 120 to 134. The thought was that pilgrims in the Old Testament on a pilgrimage to Jerusalem would be singing these psalms as they went. But then as they went up to Jerusalem, Jerusalem was on the hill, as they went up to Jerusalem, and they would climb up the steps to the temple. There was 15 steps going into the temple and one psalm for every step. So at one step, you'd sing a psalm. The next step, you sing the next psalm until you get into the temple where you're able to worship with all your people. So that's the idea of behind these psalms of ascent. So these are songs for pilgrims. These aren't songs for people who have it all together. These aren't psalms for people who feel like home is perfect and everything is fine. It's not for people going on a pilgrimage. I mean, that maybe some of us might actually go on a literal pilgrimage. But the whole point is to cultivate in us a pilgrim heart. So wherever we go, whatever kind of weird journey that we go on, our hearts are ready for it. A pilgrim heart is one that is not satisfied with the way that this world is. It's looking for something more, looking for God. See, pilgrims can be restless, they can be frustrated, they can be anxious, and they can use that energy towards finding God. Pilgrims can also be worn out, exhausted, and burdened. And then they ask God to give them what they need to carry on. See, I think we have a lot in common with refugees, with migrants, with immigrants who are searching for home. See, Jesus is the leader of this journey that we're on. And he leads us in this refugee spirituality. Now, all of us at some point, we're going to feel like we've lost something. And maybe, you know, maybe most of us might be there right now. And maybe it's also not until we need to leave where we've realized, oh, we don't have that thing that we thought we had, like the keys. Of course, for us as humans, we've lost more than keys. We've lost the most important connection, the most important relationship that can change everything in our life. Now, this is beyond a broken friendship. This is beyond a divorce. It's beyond the betrayal of a parent. The relationship we have with God, the maker of heaven and earth, as these psalms often describe him as, it's messed up. And because that relationship is messed up, we end up lost. Because that relationship is lost, we end up lost. We're going everywhere all at once, which effectively leaves us nowhere. So we're lonely, we're depressed, we're not hopeful. And we're living in a world where we should be always way more hopeful and happy than we ever have been. But it has not worked out that way. We've lived in the most lonely period that anyone's had on record. What we actually need is mercy, because we've lost something, and that something is God. What we need is mercy. Mercy from all that comes out of our lostness. So when we're lost, there's all sorts of things that kind of connect to that. There's a lack of hope, a lack of direction. Mercy can cure us of not being known, of not knowing others. Now, we started a few weeks ago about our longings in Psalm 120. We talked about how important it is to bring those to God. And it's this hunger that we have deep down that is not satisfied. We're looking for satisfaction and contentment. And for someone to get satisfaction and contentment who's looking for it, that's a mercy. That's compassion. That compassion has to come from somewhere other than us, someone other than us. In fact, the Hebrew word for mercy is also where we get the same word for grace, kind of really the overlapping meanings. And one way even to translate that word mercy could be grace. I think we could all use some grace. I think we could probably all use some mercy. And when you get that, doesn't matter where you are, you feel found. You could be, I don't know where I'm doing tomorrow, but right now I feel found. When mercy finds you, you are found. You're not lost. So Jesus sees us lost out there in our kind of the wanderings that we're doing on our own. He sees us in desperate need of mercy, and he doesn't leave us out there. He doesn't leave us lost. One of his things is that he takes us who were out there lost, needing mercy, and brings us to him. He draws us into himself. When we find him, we're found. We aren't lost anymore. So that sense of loss of not having what we needed for life, that's gone. And in its place, we have everything that we'll ever need and more. That's because he has the mercy, he has the compassion, he has the grace. And it's in knowing him that we get all those things. So if you have found him, you are not lost anymore. You are a formerly lost person. So as formerly lost people, as we are found, what we get is Jesus himself. And when we have Jesus, we find the mercy we've been looking for. So if all that's true, let's just, whatever you might think about Jesus or the Bible or church, let's assume that all that's true. If all that is true, then we should anticipate that. We should anticipate a God like that. And we should proceed and ask him for it. And those are the two things we're going to talk about. We're going to talk about anticipating mercy and asking for mercy, which is really what this psalm is teaching us to do. So the very first thing, anticipating mercy, these first two verses is anticipating it. I lift my eyes up to you. We've heard that before. It'll come up again. To you who sit enthroned in heaven, as the eyes of slaves look to the hand of their master, as the eyes of a female slave look to the hand of her mistress. So there's anticipation of something coming here. It starts like a few other psalms with our eyes lifted to God. And I think what these psalms will tell us over and over again is how important it is for our orientation to be heavenward and up instead of horizontal or down. It's such important. It changes where you go. It changes where you move. To lift our eyes up is a longing for something. You're looking for something that's not here or not here. We don't have it there. We have to look up here for it. Here also in these verses, it's combined with trust. We're looking because we believe, we trust, we think something else is going to come. We're anticipating something better than what's going on right here. And as we are spiritual refugees on this journey with pilgrim hearts, we are looking up. And if you have to look up, that means that puts you in a place lower than wherever you're looking up to. It's something that's higher than you. There's humility there. And that's refreshing because it means we don't have to be God. We don't have to have it all together. We don't have to have it all figured out. We don't look down on God. We don't even look on eye level with him. We have to look up. We're here. He's there. Far above us, but not beyond reach. And this is why we look to him. Just like that search for lost keys, as we search for him and his mercy, it leads us on a journey. And with a journey, one of the requirements, at the very least, is needing to walk. If you're not walking, you're not really on a journey. You're just loitering or hanging out or something like that. The spiritual life is often called a walk, right? Sometimes if you're in the church, you might call it your walk with Jesus, or you might call yourself a Christ follower. You can't follow someone who's not going anywhere. There's some kind of walking aspect to it. And as we go to him, he leads us along this very path that we're reading about today. Now, this next verse, on verse 2, gets a bit more specific as to who we are and how we're supposed to look. The relationship is between a slave and a master. Now, when I first hear slave and master, and you're probably the same, we think of like human chattel slavery where white people kidnapped black people and owned them. That is not exactly what's going on in the Old Testament here. That's not really the way slavery worked in this particular situation. It's not the same, but it's kind of similar to our class system. A slave in the Old Testament would have been completely dependent on their master for everything, for housing, for food, for clothing, for all that kind of stuff. But they weren't owned. But it was not exactly like an employee-boss relationship. They're not friendly with each other either. It functioned a lot like a debt system. Offering yourself up to be a slave meant taking on a debt that you worked to pay off. So the master would pay the debt off for you, and you work for them. If you've ever had a mortgage, you probably feel like you're a bit of a slave to a job in order to pay that thing off. Or paying something off with credit cards. You'd be like, I'm a slave to get this thing done in order for this to happen. If you were a slave in the Old Testament, you can only be one for a certain amount of time. Only 6 years, then it had to be set free. If you lost an eye or a tooth or broke a limb, you'd have to be set free and the debt would have to be cleared. It probably may be similar to, though none of us have experienced indentured servitude, but if I've read about that in the past, it's kind of similar to that idea of indentured servitude for a limited amount of time. Some translations, trying to get more at that, might say the word servant instead of slave. But anyway, all that said, generally not a chummy relationship, but also not one where a person owns another person. So somewhere in between those two things. At the very least, we could say there's definitely relational distance. Now, but when you were a slave, you depended completely on your master for everything for those 6 years. So as a slave looks to the master, is what the psalmist writes. That's as a slave looks to the for everything. As a slave looks to a master for everything. The power distance between the slave and the master means humility on the part of the slave. I don't have anything. I'm dependent on this master for everything. But this slave, this servant, has their hands fixed on the hand of the master. The hand. What happens with a hand is action. Something happens. Something's given. Something is going to happen with a hand. There's an anticipation. And an anticipation of something good here as well. What are they looking for? They're looking for mercy. The biggest gulf in human relationships, the distance between a master and a servant here maybe, this is how we look to God, not because he's enslaving us, but because he is so much more powerful than us and because he has all that we need. He's so much more above us. And what does he give us? He gives us mercy. He doesn't beat us or he's not out to judge us and destroy us. He's out to love us. So we look until he shows us mercy, believing that he will, because that's what he loves to give. And we look until he gives it. See, God's people are dependent people. We don't have all that we need in us. We have to look elsewhere. And God tells us to look to him. And this psalm is one of those examples. Another one is Psalm 104. And we're going to sing this after the sermon. Or no, we already sang this. All creatures of our God and King. All creatures look to you to give them their food at the proper time. When you give it to them, they gather it up. When you open your hand, they're satisfied with good things. We look to him, he gives us good things. He's not giving us horrible things, he's giving us food. I like food. Food's great. And it comes from God. That's amazing. Isaiah 30 says, yet the Lord longs to be gracious to you. He's not like, oh, I gotta be gracious to these horrible people, these horrible children. They're so, he loves it. He longs to be gracious to us, longs to give us mercy. For the Lord is a God of justice. It's an aspect of his justice. He's not held back by his justice. He's not like, oh, somehow I got to find a way to be okay to these people. No, he longs to do it. And because of that, blessed are those who wait on him. Now, waiting isn't necessarily always a passive patience. It's an active, it's a looking to, exactly what we're reading about in the psalm. Looking to something, expecting something about to happen, in anticipation. The posture of a Christian is one who's looking up, anticipating God's mercy. We look until he shows it. And what kind of mercy do we get? Whatever we need right now. Mercy for outsiders, mercy for slaves, mercy for migrants, mercy for refugees. The mercy that allows us to be honest with our needs, to be honest with our inability to overcome everything that comes at us. When we're in a difficult and needy place, the answer is not for us to grow more powerful. The answer is not for us to try and become the master here. It's not to try and flex and take on the world. No, the answer is actually to become more dependent, to go further down. To look to the one who is more powerful than we could even be ourselves and far more powerful than we'll ever need. That means we believe he has what we need and we believe he will give it to us. We will look until he shows mercy. And we are not in the place of the master. We're in the place of a servant. Now, in church terms, we love talking about how we're servants and everybody loves talking about it until they get treated like one. No one likes getting treated like a servant. I guarantee you that. I hate it. Everyone else does. No one likes that. But that's who we are. So when we get treated like that, maybe it's not right the way you were treated like that, and that's fine, but that's really who we are. Now, there are lots of masters in this world. Sometimes they're out for our good, sometimes they're not, and a lot of times there's some kind of mix in between. They don't have to be super powerful people in society. Masters are, in our kind of situation, are anyone that has influence over us. And sometimes that can be really good. Sometimes it's not. But who do we look to? We don't look to them. We look to God. We look beyond them. We don't look to raise ourselves to their level to try and become masters ourselves. We look to God who is enthroned in heaven. That means God who is able to look down on everyone, not in a like, I'm the best, isn't that amazing kind of thing, but because he's so far above us. That means God is the one who looks down, including the powerful. He looks down on anyone who might be a master in your life or in our society. So we look beyond the powerful, through the powerful, and see God. He's not just in heaven. He's enthroned in heaven. He's on a throne, ruling now, in charge of everything. It's his world, regardless of what anyone else might think. So masters might be good, might not be. It's kind of like the mountains that we looked at in Psalm 120 or Psalm 121. Maybe they're good, maybe they're not. And actually in our lives are a mix of those things, but that's not ultimately what we look to. We look to the God who is enthroned in heaven. And so what does his reign look like? What does he give us? His rule looks like this: to delight in us as he gives us his mercy. He longs to do it. He delights to do it. He loves to love us. He gives out mercy to all who are looking for it. And the way we develop this posture is hearing these words. I don't always wake up every morning believing that or even thinking about that. I kind of generally think about whatever I want to do that day, generally. I need these words all the time. I need other people speaking these words to me all the time. Of like, God loves you. I mean, that can be, anytime anyone tells me that, my day gets better. And then if anyone tells me, God loves to do that as well, God loves to love you, like that's amazing. I get better my day every time I hear that. And I bet the same thing for you. We need to be sharing this with other people. Whether Christians or not Christians, this is an amazing truth for all of us to live in. So if we're in a posture of anticipating mercy, we have to do one more thing. We don't just anticipate it and look. We have to ask for it. We have to take some kind of action. There's an action involved. Let's look at maybe the context of the action. And this is verses 3 and 4. The end of verse 3. We have endured no end of contempt. We have endured no end of ridicule from the arrogant, of contempt from the proud. There's a lot of stuff going on here. We've endured no end of it. This the person who's writing this psalm, they're fed up. They're done with it. Like, I'm at my rope's end. I can't do any more of this. You know, there's more about, in this psalm, there's more about the author's situation than the prayer itself. Have you noticed that? We've endured no end of contempt. We've endured no end of ridicule of the arrogant, of contempt from the proud. Three more lines than the actual prayer itself. And I hope that's an encouragement to you, because sometimes we can wrongly think that in prayer, it's selfish for us to pray for ourselves, or it could be bad to talk about our situation with God. That is ridiculous, and is definitely not what the Bible teaches us to do. The Bible tells us to bring all of our issues to him. And how can we do that if we don't actually talk about ourselves or talk about our situation? It doesn't have to be selfish to pray your own situation to God. That's what the psalmist is doing here, and then lots of other psalms are like that. And here, the poet is fed up. I've dealt with contempt. Contempt is like the worst way you can think of someone. It's dehumanizing. They're like, they're worthless. They're not even worth kind of being on the same level as you. Contempt is a horrible thing. So, as we are on the way to worship, and maybe as you were on the way to coming to our worship gathering this morning, we bring with us being the object of contempt. We bring that with us. That kind of bitterness that comes with that, that difficulty that comes with that, the shame that comes with that. We bring the shame that others have tried to put upon us in here and every single day. The whole premise of these psalms is that we are spiritual refugees. We're cultivating these spiritual pilgrim hearts within us. What we flee from in our journey to God, those things still have holds on us. It's not like all of a sudden if we come in those doors, everything, like the world just disappears. No, we bring that stuff with us and it still affects us. We're still dealing with the consequences of what that might be. To avoid staying emotionally broken, we bring our broken emotions with us to worship. And as we lift our eyes, as we lift our hearts, we ask him for mercy. One cannot be spiritually mature and emotionally immature. Those are the two of the same things. You can't be spiritually mature and emotionally immature. To be spiritually mature means to be emotionally mature. And knowing how to process others' contempt towards you is an aspect of spiritual maturity, emotional maturity. And we do that in prayer, as the Psalm 123 is telling us. So let's get to that prayer. What is that prayer? It's really theological, lots of big words, it's super long, it's going on and on, it's very poetic, not really. Have mercy on us, Lord, have mercy on us. We sang this already, we've already prayed this prayer during confession. You know, as one commentator wrote, and I love this, so I'm just going to repeat it verbatim. Laments flow from the lips of those who've had their fill of contempt and scorn. Laments, these like, God, I need help, flow from the lips of those who have their fill of contempt and scorn. I know you guys have experienced contempt and scorn because I've talked to you about it. To lament is to pour out your grief to the Lord. It's a hopeful act. It transforms our bitterness into something better. If we don't pour it out, it stays there. It stays in our hearts. It metastasizes. And now what was once maybe bitterness in like one little small part, and now all of a sudden that bitterness kind of gets to other parts. We didn't even know they were connected because you can't compartmentalize our hearts as much as we try to. So a little bit of bitterness on one side means bitterness throughout. And that means we might grow a little bit more insensitive. We might grow a lot more sensitive. We might grow a bit more numb. We might be a bit more angry. We might just try and push loads of things more down or have everything come to the surface. See, when you feel shame, it doesn't only stay with you. You give it to others. You will. That's how it works. If you don't give it to God, I guarantee you, you will give it to others. At the end of our service, one of the lines we say together is all our brokenness and shame. Do you know what we do? We send it to the cross. Yeah, that was really well done. So all our brokenness and shame, we send to the cross. You'll have another chance later on in the end of the service, I promise you. We send it to the cross of Christ. We actually do believe that. We actually believe all our brokenness and our shame. This is crazy. Christians really believe this. Our shame isn't on us anymore. It's on the cross. What happened at the cross? Jesus died. That shame is dead. It's not with us anymore. And so every time we say that, every time we worship together, and not just on Sundays, what we get to do, we get to be unburdened of that shame. We get to get that kind of that toxic stuff out of our bodies, and it goes with Jesus, who's already died and taken care of it. Part of the reason Jesus died was to take away your shame. Are you gonna like not allow him to take that? Of course we need to. We have to. We have to have him take it from us. As far as the east is from the west is where Jesus takes it from us. I don't know. I wonder if you have that kind of relationship with God. Do you talk to him about where you feel shame? Do you even know where that is? Shame is the thing we try and hide as far away from us as possible. Do you talk about how other people like throw their contempt upon you? We are carrying shame. Every single one of us is. And what Christians get to do, this is amazing. What we really get to do is bring it before God, and he takes it from us. We bring it before the one who knows us, who made us, and loves us, and what we get is mercy. We get relief. That's mercy. We get compassion. And these are not really big words here. They're just honest ones. The best prayers are as simple as the needs of our hearts. Have mercy on us, God. Have mercy on us. When someone shares how they've been lonely, have mercy on us. When we have to go to someone who's wronged us, have mercy on us. When someone comes to you telling how they've wronged, that you've wronged them, have mercy on us. For others to know God who don't know yet, that you love with all of your heart and they don't know Jesus yet, have mercy on us. Relief from our shame, from our lostness, from our lack of hope, from our direction. He gives it all. He loves to do it. We look until he gives us mercy and we ask for it. And so what might you need mercy for? Mercy is a really big term and we need mercy for all sorts of things. What are some of the things you might need it for in your life now? Whether you're a Christian or not yet, you can pray these simple words. When we anticipate a life under a merciful God, when we believe that to be true, we act upon it and we ask him to do it. We ask for mercy. What was lost can be found. I am a big kind of nerdy fan of the Coen brothers. There's brother directing duo. They directed, if you've ever seen Fargo, No Country for Old Men, Inside Llewyn Davis. These are all old, so completely irrelevant, of course. One of my favorite films, and just as old as maybe and as irrelevant, is Oh Brother, Where Art Thou? I don't know if you've seen this film. It takes place like after the Civil War in America, in the American South. You can see here there's three prisoners who are running. It starts off, they're on this chain gang and they run away, they escape. Their films, the Coen brothers' films are almost always filled with really rich biblical imagery and they have a background of Judaism, but they always deny that any of their films are related to anything religious. Even when they make a film about Job, they're like, no, it's not religious. Come on, guys. Anyway, okay, in Oh Brother, the three main characters, they start out in this prison, they escape, and basically the whole film is them on the run. It's a pilgrimage film. It's based on the Odyssey, and that's another pilgrimage story as well. So they're on the run. There are a good amount of times where it sounds like the character is either crying out to God or using God's name as a swear word. You're not really sure. Are they swearing or are they crying out to God? Sometimes that can be our prayer life. I think a really healthy prayer life, if someone was listening in And especially if you read these psalms, as we listen in, you're like, ooh, that sounds rough. Can you really tell that to God? Are we crying out to him? Or are we just wielding his name just to do it? And the ending of the film, this is not a spoiler, and I don't care anyway, it's old enough anyway. There's a big flood that happens, and one of the characters goes, oh God, is he crying out for relief? Or is that just a way of saying, oh no, is he using God's name in vain? When the flood of life is coming at us, how do we say, oh God, in a way of like looking to him, anticipating mercy, oh God, have mercy on us, have mercy? Or are we just saying, oh God, this is horrible, and he's just another fill-in for something bad? What do we mean? It should be a prayer to the one who can give us mercy no matter what the water's height might be. And as we anticipate his mercy, we have to ask for it. We have to do it ourselves. It creates a stronger relationship with the God who made us to begin with. And we can ask it together, because if you notice, it says, have mercy on us. Lord, have mercy on us. This is a communal prayer, not an individual prayer. It's something for us together. If I don't know what's going on in your life and vice versa, you won't really know how to pray that prayer for me, and I won't know how to pray that prayer for you. We have to know what's going on in each other's lives in order to be able to fulfill this half a verse in verse 3. Now, in order to rightly understand the Psalms, what we need to do is put the Psalms on the lips of Christ. See, the Bible is not about us first. And there's a lot of good stuff for us in there, but it's not first about us. It's first the story of God that we get to listen in on, that we are kind of end up getting to be playing very, very minor characters in. It's his story, and he's really gracious to include us in it. We've been talking about St. Augustine every now and then, who lived around 350 to 400 AD. Our fellow traveler on this spiritual journey with us, he wrote about this idea often. In fact, one of the things that he would write about is that the voice we should get used to hearing in the Psalms is none other than Christ himself. We should hear these words coming off of Christ, speaking it to us. This was Christ's pilgrimage before it was ours. He's the pioneer. He's the head. He's the one who's leading us. And he's also the one who went first. Jesus' death and his resurrection has set the path for us to go first. And God, the Holy Spirit, is with us as we walk it. So with that in mind, how do we look at this psalm? Because it changes things a bit. It's no longer first about us, because it's not really meant to be, but it is first about Jesus, so therefore it can be true about us. How does it work for Jesus to be a slave, an indentured servant, someone who's taken on a debt and become a slave? Christ became a slave so that we would never experience what that would be like. On the way to the cross, he was treated worse than a slave. He was flogged, he was tortured, he was beaten. And then when he got to the cross, he was meant to be an image of shame for everyone to see, hoisted up on top of a hill so all can see the shameful image. We deserve to be slaves because we have all been born into a debt, the debt of death itself. We come into this world imperfect, incomplete, needing to be made complete. And then we also add to our debts. Every time we sin, every time we make a mistake or do something wrong that we ought not to have, is another charge against our already overdrawn account. We're in debt. This also leaves us in shame. If you find it difficult to talk about financial debt with somebody, surely you're going to find it be difficult to talk about spiritual debt with somebody. Why do you find that difficult? Because there's shame there that we don't want to bring up. And within ourselves, even, we recoil from that shame. Where else are we going to go with our debts and our shame? Where else are we going to go? They keep us from God. They keep us from others. They keep us from our true selves. They weigh us down. And because of that, we're unable to move forward. Another reference to O Brother, Where Art Thou? This is something I only learned about in the past year. Every single time a character in that film asks for forgiveness and to be delivered, something supernatural happens and they get delivered. Every single time. Every single time they offer up the lamest prayer, you're like, they're just saying words to God because that's like the culture that they're in. Every single time, no matter how lame the prayer is, God always comes through in some supernatural way in that film. It's not religious, though. Three times, actually, specifically, where one character asks for help in what they would call a tight spot. They ask for forgiveness, and they get mercy. They get it. And that's what this psalm teaches us, because Jesus took on our debt. He took on our shame. We can ask for mercy, and he will give it. He'll give it every single time. Your lame prayers, all of our prayers are lame, okay? No one's great at it. We're all lame at it. God hears them all, and he loves to love us. He longs to be gracious to us. He will give it because and only if we are united to him. We read these words, his words, and they can become our words. His words become our words because his life becomes our life through us being connected to him. When we, for the very first time, pray, have mercy, he listens. He gives us mercy, and we are forever united to him. Our debt and shame become his debt and shame, and he did all away with that. That first have mercy now leads to a lifetime of being able to pray have mercy every single day, every single step. And out of our connection to him, the deepest, most important relationship that we can never have, we're never going to lose it. He's the one in charge of it. He will always be in the posture, we can always be in the posture of anticipating that love coming to us, and we can always ask for what we need. And this table is an image of God's mercy to us. So we do not deserve to eat at this table. This is a table that's set for the family of God. Are you good enough to be in the family of God? Yeah, of course you are, because you're connected to Jesus, because you're connected to him. He's already adopted you. We don't deserve to eat here, and yet he invites us to do so. That's insane. We can do this every single week. This is crazy. If we know what we're doing, it's crazy. We come into this world as spiritual orphans, and our good